Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Thank you, Brian. That was the voice of Brian Brown, who's our mentor and creator of the Brown Briefly. You know, Brian started the Briefly and brought with it his high standards of hosting what we believe is intelligent discussion of content and events of laced with humor and empathy, and we're struggling to do our best to maintain his
high level.
High level. There he is. Yes. And remember that he always said that less is more, more or less, which I love. And he always delivered a lot more, and we're hoping that we can maintain that standard. Every Tuesday, we continue to host the Brown Briefly here on KVSHLP Vachon. And as I said, we try to uphold his vision of what local talk radio should be. And each day, we always have an introduction, a brief teaser of who all the participants are. And by the way, I should mention before I get into that today we were supposed to have scheduled Kate Dowling, who's the executive director of Voice of Vachon, as our guest. And unfortunately, she had a sudden family schedule conflict, and she had to change her date until the 13th. Is that correct, Greg?
Yes.
13th, she's going to be here.
Yep.
So I'm having to kind of fake it this morning. I'm going to be the host. Can you believe that stuff, guys?
You got to run the board and be the host at the same time,
man,
and tap your head on the, you know,
rub my tummy.
Yeah,
it's going to just, I mean, I'm multitasking here, so boy, cut me some slack. It's a tough one. So, hey, anyway, I was going to say that we usually start the show with just a little teaser about who all the participants are. And I thought that, you know, people should get to know us a little better. And so, how about taking a little time, Bruce, and telling us about yourself, and who you are, where you were born, where you were raised, what your education is, you know, all that kind of stuff.
All that kind of stuff. So, sort of like walking and chewing gum at the same time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, sort of. Yeah.
Yeah. How do you summarize a desolate career in 5 minutes?
Yeah, there you go.
A minute.
Can you give us the scurrilous? Give us the
scurrilous
version.
Born on an auspicious, dark, and rainy night.
There you go.
No, I was actually born in Washington, D.C.
Really?
Yeah. My dad was a civilian with the Navy.
Oh, I'll be sure.
He was working for RCA, doing electronic stuff, and the Navy recruited him to do underwater sound warfare, basically anti-submarine stuff. So he was at the Naval Research Lab in Washington, D.C. when I was born, and lived there till I was about 10 years old. So grew up in the suburbs of a big city, basically, which was fascinating as a kid because they still had trolleys. We could still ride the trolleys down to downtown Washington, D.C., down to the mall, to the Smithsonian, all that kind of stuff. And then when about 10 years old, we moved to Panama City, Florida, which is in the panhandle, northwest Florida. Right now represented by Matt Getz.
Oh,
so can I imagine? It's sort of like West Texas.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds familiar.
So moving from Washington, D.C. to a county, a town with about 15, 18,000 people, it was a bit of a culture shock. And then moving from what they considered the north, and Washington's sort of one of those sort of borderline cities. But moving into the deep south, I mean, it's sort of South Alabama, Florida crackers is what they call the local residents there. So it was like moving from Washington, D.C. to West Texas, Truman. I think you can appreciate that.
I can.
But it was fascinating because, you know, it's kind of like a fish in water doesn't understand where it is necessarily. I mean, I moved... This is the mid-1950s. I mean, the schools were segregated. when even in the late 50s, I graduated from high school 61, went to a fully segregated white high school, and riding the bus to high school, we went two blocks away from the black high school. Mm. You know, and it was just that sort of amazing kind of, and you knew it was there, but you didn't know it was there because it was just so accepted. And as soon as you move away from it, you look back on it and you think, oh, holy gosh, how did we not see what was going on?
Mm-hmm.
So, but from there, I went on to college at Stetson University, started as a music major. And then switched to American Studies, went to Florida State, got a master's degree, went to the University of Texas in Austin, worked on a PhD in American Studies, didn't finish there, went and taught for a while, came back, moved out to Seattle eventually, and then finished my PhD at UW in history. So if you notice a pattern there, sort of a westward movement.
I was going to say, west and north. Yeah, got it.
And north. Yes, from one corner of the country to the other corner of the country. And then in Seattle, you know, it's like all of us have had a variety of careers, mostly in teaching. But I had an interesting stint in the late 70s and early 80s started working for Chuck Collins, who was the sort of the administrative assistant guy for the King County executive. Escaping me right now. But I worked for John Spellman and Chuck Collins. And then Collins was appointed director of Metro Transit. This was before Metro. This was Metro was separate from King County. So had a water clean sort of the sewer side of Metro and the transit side of Metro. It was there during the tumultuous time of the gas crises and sort of introducing part-time bus drivers. I mean, it was really fascinating.
Wow.
And then went from there to Green River Community College as a dean. And was at for 10 years and then went back in the classroom and been doing that till I retired and still doing it. And started the Australia-New Zealand program about 20 years ago now. So sort of interesting kind of career. And then started at Green River, I was teaching Pacific Northwest history. And so as a result of that, got interested in Vashon history. And so 20-some-odd years ago, had a sabbatical and started the Vashon sort of history project and been working on that ever since. So quick five-minute sort of summary.
Oh, that's fabulous. How long have you been with the Heritage Museum, Bruce? Were you one of the original folks?
I became a board member of the Heritage Museum. In fact, when I took the sabbatical and started working on Vashon history, so 1999, 2000, so 23 years been involved with the museum.
Wow.
And I've watched it change. Like, I mean, like you guys working with Voice of Vashon, I was a board member for a while, 10 years ago or so. And the organization has changed tremendously over those 10 years. And it's very satisfying to see those kind of things happen.
Absolutely. Wow, that was great, Bruce. Thank you very much. Look at how much we're learning about.
Oh, I know. I just thought that Bruce was somebody who
he just was kind of materialized here.
Just a guy on the stereo. on the computer here.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. All right, Craig, you'll love this. I had a Fulbright lectureship kind of thing, a traveling thing in China. Well, two actually, one in China. And I'm trying to remember now, it was like 1982, 83, something like that. So just right after China had opened.
And they established the Fulbright. No, I'm just kidding.
It feels like it.
Yeah. Cool.
But it's interesting China at that time was still very much still organized in work units, still very much a product of the Mao sort of Cultural Revolution. It was in Shanghai, Beijing, Xi'an, and where else was I? Oh, Wuhan, where the virus began.
Yeah, right.
So it's really was fascinating. And, I would love to go back because I see photographs of those areas. I mean, when I was in Shanghai, the old Bund area was still, you know, the original 19th century buildings. Wow. You go now, and across the river was nothing. You go now, it looks like Hong Kong, you know, right. Triple sized. So it's really fascinating.
Wow. Interesting. Okay, Kevin, your turn.
All right. So, Bruce, I may have been going to Green River when you were at Dean there. I only went for a quarter in about 75. But, got me off to a good start. So I'm a Seattle native, born and raised in West Seattle. But at the tender age of five, we moved to Renton. And just to hang on to our Seattle roots, my father decided that our mailbox should be a block away because that was the border between Seattle and Renton. So he wanted to make sure to preserve a Seattle address. And we got to walk, you know, through the neighbor's backyard to our mailbox every day to pick up the mail as a consequence. So. Hang out in the, Seattle area, went to school in Renton, went to school at UW. Along the way to pay the freight, I ended up working for Clark Boat Company and built San Juan sailboats.
Oh, wow.
So number 21s boats. And 24s. Yeah. Worked on did the deck design work of the 28. And the 30 was just coming into the shop when I ended up finding a more sustainable means of employment, but learned how to sail with Clark Boat Company, basically. Yeah, it was a step up from the El Toros that I learned how to sail when I was, 3 feet tall. let's see, along the way, after graduating UW, I decided I finally had enough money to start working for Boeing to go buy a decent bicycle. So I went down to Greg's Green Lake, and the guy says, touring or racing? And I said, racing sounds interesting. So he put me on a bike with a short wheelbase, and it changed my life, and I had to get into racing, which I did. I wasn't very good, so I started to do bike race promotions, and actually was the race director for the Wheat Thins Mayor's Cup in Bellevue, and that was a big national event, and it was pretty impressive. Eric Heiden was part of the 7-Eleven team, so that was a big draw there, gold medalist. But the thing that really struck me was Lenny Wilkins came walking through just to check things out. And I thought that was probably the biggest notable, if you will, that wasn't invited. but at that point, I realized I wasn't going to make any money promoting bike races. So I went back and redoubled my efforts at Boeing. And I can't say much about that, except for the last 10 years, I did technology development. And probably the most interesting was working with groups who normally didn't talk to each other. Hmm. So the business development and customer relations folks, they always talk to each other, but they really didn't like to talk to engineers very much. And so I was that engineering representative to do technology development and IR&D, which we develop stuff for our customers. So that was pretty cool.
I can see that you would be very good at that, Kevin. Making that connection. I see you in that role very clearly.
Yeah. Well, I think that I started off with some rough edges and they knocked them off, I think, pretty routinely. So, the result is what you see now. Let's see, as part of Boeing, Susie and I decided we needed to do a little more than just work because I am a still unrecovered workaholic. So, she convinced me we should do some car camping, and that got me into doing some hiking, and that got me into doing some snow and rock climbing. And one day when I was hanging on the side of a rock alone out in Royal Basin, not sure if I could get to the top, and thinking, I'm going to be the guy who gets stuck on this rock and they have to come and lift me off with a helicopter, right? Yep. I decided to join the scrambling program with the Mountaineers. And so have done quite a bit of scrambling over the course of a decade since then, and actually taught the scrambling program and first aid programs and the avalanche awareness at Mountaineers. And I still offer that course today for those who are going to go out in snow conditions. So we want to make sure you come back.
Cool.
Then I retired in 2015, and immediately thereafter, I realized the threat of the former president, which we did our best to help not get into office, but we failed. But at least we only suffered 4 years with his tenure. And, so most people know me in that role because as a workaholic, I didn't get to know too many people on Vashon. particularly with the, you know, 8 to 10 hours a day and then the commuting on top of that.
Oh, yeah.
So it's pretty much, you know, nose down, tail up.
Wow. And how long have you lived on the island, Kevin?
About 30 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, we moved in mid-90s.
Cool.
To the island, yeah. Yeah, it was a great move. We were in Puyallup, South Hills, the only 7 years I lived outside of Pierce or outside of King County. Hmm. Susie was working in Olympia. Oh, yeah. And I was working in Kent, and we decided to find a place about halfway between, and Puyallup worked. And frankly, I'm very happy to have found Vashon. Susie's insistence that we move out of our old house, which I dearly loved, but we found an awesome place here on the island. So that's definitely a step in the right direction.
Cool. Okay, Craig, your turn.
Well, I spent the majority of my life as a troll in my basement. No, actually, I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where my family either worked for Miller High Life or Harley-Davidson. Most of my uncles and relatives did that. At the age of one, I packed my bag and moved to Portland, Oregon. Actually, my father and moved us, my mom and my brother and sister. Stayed there a year, moved to San Mateo, California. Stayed there for 7 years. Moved to a little town in northern Ohio, Elyria, Ohio, where our representative today is jacketless Jim Jordan.
Oh!
You win.
You guys both escaped some amazing performance
recognition. Lived there for 7 years and moved to Los Altos, California. Then went to college, started out of college at University of California, Santa Barbara, where I was a pre-med major until I hit organic chemistry. then transferred to the relatively new UC campus, a UC Santa Cruz, the Banana Slugs, where somehow I graduated all told in 4 years. Even though I flunked out of UC Santa Cruz, pass-fail school. It's not easy to flunk out. But I lived in a little house on the beach just south of the boardwalk in Santa Cruz. So the beach was always there tempting me. And it really is easy to flunk out of school if you don't go to school.
That does have an effect.
But I got lucky. I never checked my mail on campus, and they didn't figure out that I had failed, so they let me be admitted, re-register. And when I finally got the mail about 4 months later, I went to my counselor and I said, I flunked out. And he goes, well, I'll check into it. And he came back and he goes, you know, you did so well this last quarter, we decided to let you stay. So,
nice.
So procrastination sometimes does work.
Yeah.
Moved from Santa Cruz to Spokane, where I went to law school at Gonzaga. Worked at four different jobs, working my way through school at Gonzaga. Graduated second in my class, JD, to which my mother, who's the master of understatement, said, oh, that's great. You know, that's my son. Never the best, never the worst. Went to work as a law clerk for a judge in Tacoma. After that, I became an assistant attorney general. But I was in the education division originally, and one of my clients was the Green River College back in 1977, 78, that time frame, along with the Evergreen State College and a few others dealing with all of their various issues. Then I was offered a job at the attorney general's office in Spokane where I could represent the community colleges and Eastern Washington College and what university and the college there, and do antitrust and consumer protection. And I thought that was the plum job in the attorney general's office. And I always wanted to use my law degree to do as many different things as possible. The idea of specialization did not appeal to me. It hurt me economically, not horribly, but being a generalist is not the way to make $1 zillion as a lawyer, but it's much more satisfying. After I was in Spokane a little while, I got offered a job as a full-time law professor, to my surprise, at the age of 30. at Gonzaga, and I taught constitutional law and criminal law and personal injury law, torts. Did that for almost 9 years. Then I got an opportunity. I was offered a full scholarship to go back to law school at UC Berkeley, and I got a LLM, Master of Laws degree in international practice, because I thought that would be a good challenge to try to figure out the legal systems of all the rest of the
world.
The world, exactly. So after I was done with that, I moved to Vashon. Because at the time I had a job offering for a law firm in Seattle and teaching at the law school down in Tacoma before they were bought by Seattle University. I thought, where do I want to live between the two? And I decided, no offense to people who live in White Center and those places, but I thought I wanted to move to Vashon. And that's what I did. A lot of different jobs in my career. Amway salesman, paper boy, door-to-door light bulb salesman, furniture mover, orthopedic children's shoes salesman. That's where I learned actually to fit shoes. Most shoe salesmen don't know how to fit shoes. No. Most people don't know how to fit their own shoes, to tell you the truth. But because I had these little kids, I needed to really learn what I was doing there. Ice cream maker, worked in ice cream. I was a Pinkerton guard, as we've said before, guard in 747. Tow truck driver, apprentice car mechanic, and a number of other things. Private practitioner. In private practice, like I said, I like to do a lot of different things. I did a lot of contract work, international contract work, a lot of international arbitration work. But because of the fact that I taught criminal law and criminal constitutional law, I would occasionally get what I consider to be high-profile or interesting criminal law cases, including representing an individual accused of being the Green River Killer, which resulted in King Five landing their helicopter out in our field by our house to get an interview. Wow. Couldn't get in and out of my office without trying to fight my way through the news people. That was an interesting one. And some other ones where I represented a fellow who robbed banks up and down the West Coast. He was referred to by the police as the shootist because he would pull out a .38 and fire a couple of shots into the ceiling before he would jump over the cage and wow. empty the drawers. I got very upset at him. I think I may have mentioned this on a prior show because I looked at the list of the banks that he robbed, and one of them was my mother's bank in Los Altos, California. with that, and then when I came to Vashon, and I'll wrap this up, I got involved right away in things. I got named by the county to chair a committee called the Vashon Governance Options Committee, where we looked into all the various kinds of governance that we might be able to employ on Vashon Island. And after that, I joined the board of the Land Trust, one of the original board members of the Land Trust, became the president of the community council for many years after that, president of VAA after that, now VCA, first male board member on the Dove Project after that, and now on the August group of board members for the Voice of Vashon.
Hear, hear. Great. Wow. I tell you what, I'm feeling like a biker following you guys. Gee whiz. I got one for you, though. I was born in Carlsbad, New Mexico. How about that?
I didn't know that.
Yes, sir. Nice. And I didn't make it to the caverns until I was like 24 years old. But my father always said, yeah, we were down in the caverns and this bat came by and dropped a little guano there, and there you were. Yeah. Yeah, he was a lovely.
Nice story, yeah.
Yeah, lovely man. But by about 6 months old, I moved back to West Texas, where my whole family was from. And my only claim to fame there, my father started a cotton farm because he was a cattle rancher, but there was a huge drought, a 7-year drought, and he knew that there was deep water there from working in the oil fields as a kid. So he drilled a deep water well and put in a cotton farm. Everybody said he was crazy, but we produced a lot of cotton. But my big claim to fame there was that we were only about 5 miles away from Pyote Army Air Base. And Pyote, P-Y-O-T-E, is where they stored many of the heavy bombers after World War II. And I can remember driving down the highway, old Highway 80, and seeing all these airplanes out there shimmering in the sun. One of the airplanes was the Enola Gay, the B-29 that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. And in fact, it flew over our house on its final flight going out to the Air and Space Museum out in D.C.
Wow.
So I thought that was kind of cool. And in fact, I got to climb around on some airplanes out there one day. And I think, I don't know for sure, but I think that I might have gotten to be able to climb up in the Enola Gay because my father, again, told us, you know, that was the important airplane. But anyway, 11 years old, my father had the opportunity to go to Montana where my grandfather had a ranch. And dad was able to get back into ranching, which was really great. Lived up in eastern Montana. Now, I have to tell you this part. When I first moved to Montana, I was only 11 years old, right? And it was in January. I may have told this before, but we went and we had to go buy me some clothes. And did I tell you this already about the shoes? So the salesman said, oh, these are the shoes that all the kids are wearing.
Oh.
You know, they were all tall, high-top lace-ups, you know, leather. And so I said, okay. You know, I wore that and had a parka, which I'd never had before. And my first day of class, the only kid that wore those high-top lace-up shoes was Wormy Weldy. And everybody looked at me like, well, not only did I talk funny, but I look funny. So
you know what the lesson is there?
Yes.
Never trust a shoe salesman.
I knew that. I actually knew that all along. but anyway, so graduated from high school there, played in the band. I told you all about that stuff. I went to the Eastern Montana College in Billings. I did really well in skiing and drinking wine. And not so well in school, so I decided to go back to our community college there in Miles City, where I grew up, for one quarter, and then said, you know what, they're going to draft me if I don't enlist. So I enlisted, and I have to correct one thing that you folks have been including in the intro. I was a military intelligence, but I was not an officer. I was an NCO, which is a non-commissioned officer, E5. So I guess you could say I was an officer, military intelligence, but it was actually a non-com.
But you were intelligent.
Well, that's another, that's debatable. That part is very debatable. But I did get to go through Fort Holabird Intelligence School, which was really, really an interesting event. That's in Baltimore. It used to be in Baltimore. And it was like being on a college campus. Anyway, got sent to Vietnam, had a wonderful time there, and as you can imagine, and then went to Europe in Germany. And the whole mission there was, I have to tell you that in Vietnam, we were strategic intelligence. We were supplying battlefield commanders with the information they needed in order to, for their day-to-day combat operations. And when we got to Germany, that was more strategic intelligence. We're looking at long-range kind of stuff. It's much, much more challenging and interesting. For me. Anyway, got out of the Army, went back to college, got my degree, and I majored in anthropology and in psychology. And I have to tell you this part, psychology was my real interest. But I had to take a course in computer science, since I had one brother who was a computer analyst, and I took a course in introduction to anthropology, since my other brother was an archaeologist. Hated computer science, hated it. Loved anthropology, took all anthropology courses, and graduated with a double major in psych and anthropology. Both really useful degrees to have. What? I'm not sure.
You hated the...
computer stuff.
Then that's why we made you the head of the tech...
That was it. Well, we were programming in COBOL and Fortran, right. Give me a break.
Student programming language.
It was horrible. Anyway, graduated from college, came out here, went to work for the Army again for the Coordinating Center for Prevention of Alcohol and Drug Abuse down at Fort Lewis. Was working as a statistician. Statistics were the least favorite course that I had in college, and of course, I became a statistician. And then shortly moved into director of a counseling center for high school kids, which was one of the most rewarding jobs I think I've ever had. It was really, really amazing. We lost our funding when I think it was Reagan came in and cut, you know, all the social funding. And so I lost my job. I went back to school for my master's. About the time we lost our funding was the very end of my program. So I never did turn in my thesis, so didn't get the piece of paper, but did complete the education. Anyway, ended up coming out to Vashon. Got hired I have to tell you one thing here. I'll do that in a minute. Got hired by Campfire Girls and was at Camp Sealf for 3 years, superintendent, kind of running all the facilities there. Finally decided that the only thing I ever wanted to do was fly airplanes, since I had soloed way back when. Had all of my ratings. And at age 32, I got a job on Boeing Field, flight instructing. And anyway, the story goes on from there. Went up to Alaska, flew DC-4, flying off the beach, hauling fish. Just a tide table and a chart, and that's all there was. No approaches, no nothing, which was a pretty exciting thing. 2 years I did that. 1 year as a first officer and 1 year as a captain. Came back to the Seattle area and decided I had to get a real job. Got hired by San Juan Airlines, flying Cessna 402s. From there went to Horizon, and from Horizon to Alaska, and finished my career there. Moved back to the city when I started flying, and didn't come back to the island until 1991, and then retired in 06. So there I am. That's the whole story. Yes, Craig?
I've been elected to tell one more thing that yes. None of us would be where we are today without our wonderful, beautiful, and talented wives.
No question.
So I thought I'd add that for sure.
Yeah, no question. Yeah, I was married in 1970, so it's been a day or two, and she whipped me into shape pretty quickly. I did have two jobs when I was going to college. I was swamping, as I used to call it, in a bar early in the morning, the Monk's Cave, which I would put on the music really loud and mop the floors and clean up all the detritus that was there. And I also worked at a gas station, pumping gas and cleaning windows. In those days, of course, checking tires and cleaning windows and checking the oil. You know, we gave full service.
So. When you heard the ding.
That was it, when they ran over the hose out there. Yep, yep. All right, that's my story. Yeah, Kevin.
Yeah, Truman, I also had a chance to work at a gas station, Simba's Exxon on Mercer Island. And Simba's was owned by an East Indian who had been kicked out of Kenya when apparently Idi Amin woke up one morning from a syphilitic dream. He had syphilis, so yes. That whatever that does to your brain, dreaming that all of the non-blacks were milking the cows of Uganda. The owner of Simba's Exxon got booted out of the country, went into Canada, eventually migrated into the United States. I went to college with his sons. They were colleagues of mine, and I worked at the gas station. It was an interesting time to be seeing his serving the people of fine people of Mercer Island, given his heritage and his history. Apparently multimillionaire in Uganda with a trucking firm, but he lost it all and got back on his feet. So
wow.
Amazing stories out there.
There are amazing stories. And the people we meet, especially here on Vashon, it's fascinating. You know, I mean, just our little capsule here of the four of us, you know, really shows the variety of experiences here. Well, I have to talk about today in history. I did a little research, of course. Today was a very important day. In 1785, Benjamin Franklin announced the invention of bifocal lenses. Mm-hmm. Boy, was that a wonderful invention, I'm telling you. I'll tell you a quick story about that. I was flying, of course, with the airlines, and I found that as it became evening, that I was having trouble seeing the charts, right? And so I had a pair of reading glasses, so I would swap them out back and forth. That is not the way to fly a jet, I can tell you right now, swapping glasses. So finally, a friend of mine with the airline said, tell you what you do, get a pair of glasses, get your seat all arranged, and put a line right at the top of the yoke there where we would hang our charts, and go to the optometrist and say, that's where I want the line for my bifocals. which was quite low. And I did that, and wow, it changed my life, you know? So thank you, Ben, from 1785. In 1903, the first automobile trip across the U.S. left San Francisco for New York, and it arrived on July 26th. And I was going to do the math, and I failed to do that. But anyway, from May 23rd to July 26th, so about a month and 3 days, 2 months and 3 days.
Do you know what car it was?
I don't.
Do you know Bruce?
You know Bruce?
No.
I watched that movie or whatever, but I don't recall.
Oh, shoot. I thought we were going to get it right here. No. All right. And given today's news, in 1922, Walt Disney incorporated the first film company. It was called Laugh-O-Gram Films. How about that? And in 1934, the outlaws Bonnie and Clyde were both, they were killed in an ambush in near Sales, Louisiana. So there you go. But the most significant event of this date was in 1962, when Truman O'Brien actually first soloed in a Piper PA-28 supercruiser. So that was today, in 1962. How about that?
Wow. By the way, it was a Winton. The car.
A Winton.
A Winton, yes.
Never heard of him.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, so, you know, normally at this point in the show, actually quite a bit earlier at this point in the show, we start our small talk segment. That's our new segment that we have. And that's where we bring in a guest from a variety of organizations here on the island, which really is, I think, has been a great format for us. I've really enjoyed it. We've met some fascinating people and covered some really interesting topics. But since we don't have one today, you guys said that, okay, you just have to come up with something. Good luck with you. So anyway, let's start with local. We have the upcoming a levy vote for the Vashon Island Fire and Rescue Group. And they are considered a junior taxing district. And so I thought I would just take a minute. It's kind of complicated. But the term junior taxing district includes all taxing districts which are other than state, counties, road districts, cities, towns, port districts, and public utility districts. That's right out of the manual. And in fact, they are rank ordered. We have in Washington State a $5.90 cap. So in other words, if the Park District has 45 cents and the Cemetery District has 3 cents and Library is 29 cents, when all of those are added up, they cannot be more than $5.90. Now, the tricky part of this is that when you get your first allocation of levy money, you get a dollar amount. So, for example, with the Vashon Park District, the whole property values out here on Vashon Island are about $3.9 billion. If you take 45 cents of a thousand of that, that comes out to $1,700,000. So they take that number. The next year, if property values have increased, they can't increase more than 1%. So 1% over that $1,700,000. So consequently, they may not get their full 45 cents. They might get 42 cents. The next year, property values increase. They only can increase by 1%. So maybe they're going to get 40 cents. Well, as it turns out, on the last election, by the last levy election for the Park District, they were at actually 31 cents. So we voted in a new rate of 45 cents. So this starts all over. So that actually accounted to a 14-cent increase in tax that we voted for. I'm not going to go into the Vashon Island Fire and Rescue thing because we're going to save that, I think, for a later date when we get a little closer to the election. But these things are rank ordered. So, for example, EMS countywide. Fire District Number 13, Vashon. Hospital District Number 5, Vashon. King County Rural Library District, Cemetery District, and Vashon Park and Rec District. That is the rank order that those occur in. So if the $5...
Truman, is the airport district in this?
I'm going to talk about that in just 1 minute. Just 1 minute.
Patience.
Yes, patience. What happens is that if the $5.90 cap is hit before getting down to, for example, the Park District, which is last, say that we voted in 45 cents, but if we get down to that and it's $5.80, that would mean the Park District only is going to get 10 cents. So they are restricted by in rank order as they go down. Now, the King County Airport District Number 1, which is the Vashon Municipal Airport, is currently a non-taxing district. However, we do have the authority to pass a levy up to 75 cents per thousand.
Ooh.
So we have not chosen to do that. We have chosen to maintain ourselves. But if conditions continue as they have, where our costs keep going up due to King County, we may, in fact, be in a position where we're forced to do that. We're committed to not doing it, but believe me, the option is there. So that's what we have for the local news. Any comments, questions, Kevin?
And where does that airport commission fall in that hierarchy of prioritized district?
I don't know that. I don't know that answer. I would suspect that it might be a little bit above the Park District and maybe even the Cemetery District, but I don't know that. I don't know that fact. I should. I should look that up.
Hey, Truman, are there any other districts on the island like Airport District that doesn't tap into the taxes at this point?
Not that I'm aware of. Now, you may have more information about that, but no, I'm not aware of any others that are there. I find that, in fact, I was pretty surprised that the Airport District had that authority, but we definitely do. It's in the RCW. Yeah, Kevin.
And I do see that Truman, you refiled for your position there, so folks will be able to recognize your the low impact on our tax base.
They can. That's right.
By returning you to office.
That's right. Thank you very much for that endorsement. I appreciate that. At least I assume.
Wait, but that wasn't an endorsement.
Well,
it was just.
I felt like it was an endorsement. Come on.
I wanted to make people aware. I think, you have some credentials here that they should be factoring into their.
We don't want to threaten Voice of Vashon's nonprofit status.
That's right.
We can't. No endorsements.
You're right. Okay. All right. So I'll just accept that as a
notice
thereof. Okay, so hey, let's look at national news here for a minute. George Santos has been indicted on 13 counts.
Only
13, but oh my gosh, some of these claims are amazing. If you go on to Vox 2, I think they're one, or actually Every Lie New York Magazine, that's the best one that will give you all of the lies that he stole. And so do you guys have any favorites? I mean, can you pick out any, Greg? Kevin, go ahead.
I'm going to say, I think the favorite lie, and I don't know if the New York Times picked up on this, but his denial of being that drag dancer in Brazil before he relocated. I think he probably denied that somewhere along the way, but I think he's probably looks a lot like the person in the video. So it's very possible.
I think that's probably it. Greg?
I kind of appreciate one of his very latest representations where he says that if he's expelled from the legislature, he will rejoin the Beatles.
Oh, that is good. Well, you know, this brings up a wonderful term that I learned not too long ago, and that's the word is equivocation. I recently saw a play that's called Equivocation, and if you don't know what it is, it's a very interesting concept. It is that when you answer a question, you need to answer the question that's really being asked, not necessarily what's being said to you. So, for example, the example they gave was you're hiding the king in your home, and you're a priest, and you're hiding the king in your home. And the people arrive to arrest the king and of course, kill him. And so they ask you, is the king here? Well, what they're really asking is, can you give us the king so we can take him out and kill him? So you have to answer no. And you can do that because you're answering the question that was really asked, not what was presented to you. So I think George Santos could use that term equivocation on several of his.
We have an expression in our family that he uses is all he uses is
yeah, uses
he
it?
Uses yeah. all the time. When we exaggerate in the Bellis household, we refer to it as embellishing. if you're going to be real charitable about Santos, you'd say he embellishes.
indeed. Oh my gosh. So hey, we've got a few minutes left here. You know, I found it very interesting that Volodymyr Zelensky actually attended the G7 summit in Hiroshima, Japan, and I believe that he got a very rousing welcome there. The fact that President Biden has now promised F-16 fighters, although I guess we're not going to produce or present them. They're coming from the Netherlands? Is that what I understand?
From other NATO countries.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we are going to train the pilots, right?
We're training the pilots.
Yeah. Does anybody know when those are supposed to get there?
No. After the pilots are trained.
Well, that would probably be a good idea. Yeah. You know, I find it interesting. One of the things that's happened is the Patriot missile system has been put into Ukraine. And I think they took out like 28 of 29 missiles in their first go around. When you combine that with the F-16s, you're going to have air superiority in a heartbeat. One of the things that these F-16 fighters can do, they have a thing called Wild Weasel. This is from Vietnam, but Wild Weasel was the guy who came in with the radar blasting and would get shot at by a surface to air missile. And as soon as he was shot at, then, boy, everybody returned fire, and they went right after the installation. Those guys were pretty brave characters that flew the Wild Weasel. Go ahead.
So the Wild Weasel, I was thinking it might have been a decoy, but it was not. It was an actual aircraft that was squawking and was the target.
Yes, sir. They would fly into it. Yeah, Greg.
This topic begs the question as to what effect will bringing those jets into this dispute have in the battle? So will Russia
capitulate?
You know, well, will they capitulate or will they up the ante?
Very good question. You know, of course, we keep reading about Putin's health and the likelihood that he may not survive. So I'm curious. What do you guys think of that? Do you think if Putin eventually succumbs to the illness, or what's going to happen with the war? Do you think they'll stop? Do you think they'll, you know, one of the things I thought was, you know, once this war is over, there's going to be a tremendous amount of rebuilding to be done in Ukraine. I wonder if it's going to be Russian companies that get those contracts. You know, it's a thought.
I doubt it.
You think so?
I think that the construction contractors will come from a little on the other side.
Yeah, maybe not. You know, who knows? I wondered about.
Oh, there is so much animosity now between the Ukrainians and the Russians that I don't think you're going to be seeing a lot of Russians working in Ukraine afterwards. And I'm afraid that this war won't end easily.
Yeah.
I think that one side will actually have to win it. I don't think it'll be negotiated. As an arbitrator and a mediator, I'd like to think it would be, but I don't really think that's going to happen.
What, given your experience and background, Craig, what kinds of things could they mediate or arbitrate? I mean,
well, you know, that's where you use your imagination.
Yeah,
and what you've got here is you've got issues of saving face. Right. Which is something you'd have to really look into, just like in the Biden, you know, negotiations that are going on over the budget right now, or over the debt ceiling. Yeah, there's a whole issue of saving face, and then there's the other issue of what are the real interests? What is it that people are really concerned about? And then you use your imagination. The whole Camp David Accords are just a fascinating study in somebody coming in and.
and going, now, wait a minute, what are you guys really interested in? And once they identified the interests, they were able to come up with a solution.
Oh, that is fascinating. Yeah.
So, Craig, in that dynamic of negotiating or arbitrating, how important is it to the current lines of control, right? Which territory is Russia in control of? Which territory is Ukraine in control of? Is that a very dominant factor in those discussions, do you think?
Well, I mean, yeah, it always is in war. And in incursions from one country to another, where you end up putting that boundary. Obviously, in this instance, Russia would like to say, well, where we're at right now is where we'll do it, you know. Yeah. And Ukraine wants to, you know, they want them out of Crimea. So there's a big difference there as to what's going to happen, what the trade-off if it comes to a negotiation and a settlement would consist of. Not an easy task.
And yes. what about Ukraine being admitted to the G7 or even admitted to the Security Council? You know, I mean.
So in other words, they could go back to being a G8.
Yeah, exactly.
With Ukraine. That they've eliminated Russia from the G8. That would be fascinating.
Yeah, but also they are talking about bringing him into the Security Council, you know, where they would have a veto. I mean, that to me would be fascinating. Mm-hmm. Do you have any background on that, Bruce, about the Security Council?
I think the real issue is whether Ukraine's going to become part of NATO.
Yeah.
You know, if Ukraine becomes part of NATO, then the very nature of the NATO agreement is all of us are against Russia in warfare. And that's the fine line that we're walking right now. And it's sort of, I mean, this is a proxy war. I mean, this is no different than Korea, no different than Vietnam, no different than Afghanistan, no different than the struggles going on in Africa right now. Mm. I mean, it's proxy wars that have been going on since the beginning of the 20th century, since Russia became sort of the communist menace, if you will. You know, you go back to the white Russians and the red Russians, same kinds of proxy wars going on. So my sense is it's going to be a difficult, and I agree with Craig. I mean, you would hope there would be a negotiated settlement, but both sides are so dug in and literally dug in.
Yeah.
It's going to be very difficult, I think, to find a solution other than a military solution. And then the difficulty there is if Ukraine starts to become victorious, Russia has nukes.
True.
And, you know, at what point, you know, if Ukraine starts to invade Crimea, what point are the Russians, whether it's Putin or not? I mean, Putin, if Putin gets kicked out of power, there's going to be another Putin. I don't think we'll go back to a Boris Yeltsin leadership in Russia.
Right.
Yeah. So it's sort of like, wow. That's the danger, I think, in Ukraine right now, is there are no easy solutions.
Exactly.
Yeah, Kevin.
Yeah, Bruce, I'm curious about your perspective. There's a school of thought that says that Russia deserves to have a buffer, like a neutral buffer between the NATO nations of Western Europe and the Eastern, you know, Russian-controlled nations. There's been a historic buffer with the USSR, and that, in fact, it's NATO aggression, which is an expansion, and that the aggressive expansion of a militarized state, if you will, that is actually creating a threat to Russia and in invoking them to take the actions that they're taking. So that's one school of thought. I'm curious, you know, from a historian's perspective, if you have a point of view about that, and given the fact that we're talking about Ukraine perhaps becoming a member of NATO, Finland just got admitted. So they just increased the border between NATO and Russia by, I don't know, 1,800 miles, whatever it is. What's your notion of this idea that there should be these buffer zones between Russia and the West, Western Europe?
Well, yeah, I mean, go back to Napoleon. I mean, Russia's always feared invasion from the West, and some ways justifiably so. And just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you, right? And so Russia's always been paranoid of the West. And in effect, what Russia did after World War II was create these sort of client states, if you will, or along the Iron Curtain to provide that buffer. You know, well, the collapse of the Soviet Union sort of removed that buffer. And you're right. I mean, Russia is very concerned about an invasion from the West. Whether that's justified or not, I'm not sure it's justified. But that's the reality of the Russian-Soviet mindset. Yeah, Craig.
You know, that is the way they resolved the Israeli-Egyptian issue, is they were concerned about buffer zones and security and whatnot. And everybody talked about, where are we going to put the boundaries? Where are we going to put the boundaries? Well, you know, the country's boundaries. And they finally resolved and said, well, if you're so interested in security, how about if we leave the boundaries where we want them, but we agree that we won't put any military or any type of armament within X number of miles of that border, so that you have your security, but we have our border, our historic border. And that's how they were finally able to resolve that issue.
Hmm. You know, when I was in, it reminds me, when I was in Germany, you know, we were in, and we had East and West Germany at that time. Being in an intelligence unit, I was not allowed within 5 kilometers of the East-West border. And because of the, likelihood that, you know, we could get involved in something we weren't supposed to be involved in.
There are all kinds of places you're not allowed to be within so many feet.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it does go back to the Star Trek concept of the neutral zone between the Romulans and the Federation. Yeah. I mean, there are reasons to have neutral zones, and you know, Middle East was a good example of that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's what the Soviets tried to create after World War II. You know, with those client states, you know, mm-hmm. Poland and Czechoslovakia and Romania, and you know, Balkans, they were essentially a neutral zone for the Russians under their control. Mm-hmm. So how to get back to that, or how to get Russia to be not paranoid, those are almost insurmountable.
Yeah, Kevin.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting thing. You know, the notion that you open doors to Russia, they become part of the G8, you do trade, right? Germany consuming Russian petroleum products, building trade, building trust, building relationships. You know, the last time Russia was invaded, as far as the research I've done, was in Nazi Germany in 1942 or whatever it was, right? After Hitler had taken all of Europe and decided he wasn't going to cross the channel and threaten Britain, he's going to do as he said in Mein Kampf. He's now going to take on the Russians. Mm-hmm. And of course, we don't have leaders like that not as many.
Thank goodness.
Few and far between. Yeah, it's hard for me to see what aggressors Russian is worried about today. And in fact, if I look at their recent history, it looks like they're projecting this fear of aggression, their own aggression, onto others, is what I can see. But you know, the history, maybe I don't see all the history yet. I'm looking into this to see what I might learn.
Yeah, you can't ignore the sort of Christian nationalism in Hungary and in Russia, and the woke West is a threat. Mm-hmm. So you know, it's not just militarily, it's culturally, and I think those are powerful motivators right now, and for Putin and for Orban and for those sort of leaders in Russia and Hungary.
You know, one of the things that we talked about, we've only got about 30 seconds left here, but one of the things we talked about at the very beginning of this whole conflict was, I was saying that I thought it'd be over in a day or two, which Russia thought as well. And that was from my experience in Europe when they invaded Czechoslovakia. But what we didn't take into account was the infrastructure, or the lack thereof, in Ukraine. They were forced to go down these little tiny narrow roads, and they just did not work. Mm-hmm. So the buffer there is environmental as well as cultural and actual. So, hey, guys, next edition of our Brown Briefly is going to be Mike Suddeth and Kim Van Hinkle, who will be discussing the Burton Historic Trail. So I'd just like to say, from Bruce, Kevin, Craig, and myself, thanks a lot for tuning in, and we will see you next week.
Bye now.
Thanks.